Hello, this is Dee with the Vermilion County News for April 3rd, 2017. We'll begin our recording with the front page story entitled The Hot Stuff, Volunteer Firefighters Train in Live Fire Scenarios by Brendan Dennison of Danville. For some county volunteer fire departments, having the chance to train can be a real challenge. So says Kickapoo Fire Protection District Chief Roy Lester. Although there is a firefighter training institute at the University of Illinois in Champaign, Lester said it can be difficult to get his crew out there because some of them work full-time jobs. On March 18th, his department convened with the Lynch Area and Bluegrass departments to burn a house as a training exercise. Firefighters spent 12 hours at a vacant house in the 1100 block of Oakwood Avenue, practicing both smoke simulated and live fire training. In the morning, Lester said they set up practical stations for training skills related to ventilating roofs, window rescues, and portable water tank setups. He said if crews can vent the roof properly, it makes their job much easier by removing smoke and heat from inside of a house that's on fire. He added, being able to train on an actual house puts our training all together, as in real life. Lester said they would otherwise train by setting up props and skids as a makeshift frame to simulate cutting through a rafter. To cut a hole in a roof in the middle of a house fire is no easy task. Firefighters need to carry a 40-pound chainsaw up a ladder and onto a building, along with a fire axe and a Halligan bar, then hook a second ladder to the crest of the roof for extra footing. Assistant Chief Randy Schumann added firefighters also have to be concerned about climbing above an active fire because they don't know what's going on inside or below them. Lester said the crews also trained on opening up roofs the old-fashioned way, with an axe. For the rescue station, he said firefighters practiced using a ladder as leverage on a window frame to carry a victim out with it. Finally, the crews practiced setting up a portable water holding tank that a fire truck could draft from. Lester said the biggest reason they practice working with that kind of equipment is because there are a lot of rural areas in their district that don't have fire hydrants nearby. Live fire revolution. During the afternoon training session, things started to heat up a bit. Volunteer firefighters spend much of the afternoon training in four live fire drills inside and around the vacant house, and a little bit into the evening cleaning up the scene. Lester said the nice thing about having a vacant house to do live fire training is that they were able to go inside, inspect the structure, and ensure it's sound, since they're obviously not going to train in an unsound building. Unfortunately, in the real world, we don't have that luxury, he added. Lester said the first station was a rapid intervention team, which entered with a 2.5-inch hose line. The second one, described by Lester as an ignition team, went in with an instructor who started a fire to show how it evolves. He added they observed how fire tends to walk up the walls and reach toward the nearest opening. The fire wants oxygen, so the air coming from the door, that's the direction it wants to go. Lester said it wants the air so it can eat and breathe. Next, he said the third station would practice extinguishing the fire from the interior. Lester said the group was a basic fire knockdown, and his crews would look for fire extension into the walls to ensure it was completely out. He added they also observed signs of fire evolution in the kitchen. The instructor told them to pull the cabinets away from walls, and sure enough, we found more fire, he said. Finally, their fourth station completed a primary search of the house as fire was being extinguished to look for victims. Lester said that type of operation is usually done without a house. In the end, Lester was certain these types of training events help make his crews better prepared for the real deal. When going inside a house fire, He said firefighters need to rely on their other senses, such as what they hear and how hot it is, since they lose their sight to the smoke. There are a lot of different sounds inside a house fire, Lester said, a lot of cracking and popping, and your job is to determine whether the cracking and popping is the fire or the ceiling above you or the floor below you. It's a dangerous job. Our next article is entitled County Still Accepting Video Contest Entries, Awardees to Receive Gift Cards by Brendan Dennison of Danville. County officials continue to encourage residents to submit entries for their Our Vermilion County campaign video contest, in which they can describe some of their favorite things about the county. The campaign was announced at the beginning of March as a result of feedback from a strategic planning process the county did last year that asked them to promote a positive self-image. The deadline for the first quarterly contest is May 1st, and subsequent contests will begin on the second day of June, September, and December. County Board Chairman Mike Marin said in a telephone interview Friday, officials already have been in contact with one person who has a great concept for a video, which would absolutely be the perfect representation of the county. He still strongly encouraged the public to get involved and submit videos for the contest. The winning entries will be highlighted on the county's YouTube channel, and the video's producer also will receive a prize package provided by area sponsors. According to Marin, the county is looking to award about $100 worth of gift cards to area business to winners of the contest. I'm really wanting to engage people and get their thoughts and feelings of what they love about the county, Marin said, as well as seeing some of the great creative minds get to work, because we have some really talented people out there. A link to the contest rules can be found on the county's website, www.vercounty.org. Since the campaign launched, county board members also have produced several promotional videos highlighting local amenities, businesses, and recreational activities. The first videos featured Danville Metal Stamping and Bobette Steely Hegler Cancer Center at Presence United Samaritans Medical Center. Later videos showcased Harrison Park Golf Course, the Vermilion County War Museum, and Lincoln's historical connections to the county. For the amount of time and money invested, Marin said he felt really good about how the promotional videos turned out, and they've received a lot of views on their Facebook page. The Danville metal stamping video had been watched more than 10,000 times as of Friday. Marin added the video cost the county hardly anything. Our next article is entitled Carbon Rules Won't End Air Battle by Carrie Murakami, Washington. President Donald Trump's executive order to lift strict restrictions on carbon emissions from power plants is being hailed by the White House as the end to the federal government's war on coal. But rather than ending the war, coal industry and environmental interest combatants said the president's order signals the beginning of an anticipated long regulatory and legal battle over the issue of greenhouse emissions and dirty air. Trump, surrounded by coal miners, signed the order Monday, revoking the Obama administration's Clean Power Plant rule aimed at reducing carbon pollution. "You're going back to work," he told the miners. Yet Trump cannot simply undo all the federal carbon regulations with a swipe of his pen, said the Sierra Club's Spalding and industry legal experts, including David Kaninsky, an associate professor at Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs. They said a federal court in 2009 upheld the EPA's stance that the Clean Air Act requires it to pass rules to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to protect Americans' health. Spalding said that means the EPA will have to write new federal regulations that would comply with the clean air law and protecting against the health perils of dirty air. The president said his decision eliminates job-killing constraints tied to climate concerns and will put miners back to work, even though the regulation has never formally gone into effect because the Supreme Court froze it last year with a stay order. Even so, coal interests said the policy has led to restrictions that have hurt an industry already struggling to compete with cheaper natural gas to supply the nation's energy. Will the CPP remain in place? We won't know for years, said Joanne Spalding, senior managing attorney for the Sierra Club, which has vowed to fight in court all efforts to reverse environmental rules to reduce carbon emissions. Lawmakers from coal states expressed optimism Trump's decision on carbon emissions will help the coal industry recover from years of decline. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, in a statement, called Trump's order a positive step toward preventing the loss of more jobs and raising electric bills. West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito praised the order through a spokeswoman as an encouraging step in the right direction. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, put it in this light. Fortunately, the EPA will now have the opportunity to go back to the drawing board and get this right with balanced and serious policies. Robert Murray, chairman of Murray Energy, the nation's largest coal producer with mines in West Virginia, Ohio, Illinois, Kentucky, and Utah, embraced Trump's decision. He said the president has followed through on his promise to preserve coal jobs and low-cost electricity in the United States. Knowing the law will not be in force for the foreseeable future is still like having a solid floor to stand on, National Mining Association Vice President Luke Popovich said in an interview Wednesday. Potentially, companies that may have been thinking about mothballing a coal plant in the short future might postpone the decision, said Kenneth Trosky, an associate dean of economics at the University of Kentucky. The mining associations, Popovich said, that could amount to a multi-year process when you take into account both the government, deliberative regulatory process, and anticipated court lawsuits. Still, coal companies could benefit while all this plays out in the short term. Those in financial trouble could find it easier to obtain bank refinancing to stay afloat, said Tyler White, president of the Kentucky Coal Association. Because it takes years to execute a plant shutdown, plant closures already announced will likely continue on course despite Trump's order, said Ann Smith, managing director of NERA, an economic consulting firm that has worked with coal industry groups. But, she added, others thinking about it without making a public announcement may now reconsider if Trump's order on less restrictive carbon emissions, though the uncertainty of the situation could also affect the industry. With so much uncertainty, Smith said, no company will risk building new coal-powered plants. I would say this is mainly a reprieve for the next 4 years, she said. Trosky, the Kentucky economics professor, summed it up this way. It's not like Trump is president for life. Our next article is entitled Leaders Seek More Regulations. This is from the Associated Press out of Chicago. Four new measures proposed in the Illinois legislature would tighten the state's environmental protections on hog confinements and give local citizens more input in the permitting process, as well as standing to challenge the massive facilities in court. Critics say pork producers sometimes exploit weak laws to build and expand large hog confinements across rural Illinois, some of which hold thousands of pigs and produce millions of gallons of manure each year, the Chicago Tribune reported. Farmers and others who live near the massive facilities say their rights have been trampled, while waste poisons, local streams, and sickening gases ruin families' lives and property values. What is going on in our rural communities and to many of our farmers and farm families is wrong and unjust, and we can do better than this for them, Fulton County farmer Craig Porter said. He described a frustrating effort to stop a proposed 20,000-head hog facility near his property. The legislation, announced at a Tuesday news conference in Springfield, was proposed in response to an August investigation by the Tribune. The bills would represent the first significant reforms to the state's 1996 Livestock Management Facilities Act, which has been criticized for failing to keep up with the dramatic growth of swine confinements. Farming and livestock groups tell the Associated Press the legislation places more regulatory burden on livestock farmers and is redundant. Unfortunately, the legislation introduced by Senator Kohler does little to further enhance environmental protections, said Richard Gubert, Jr., president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, in a statement. Instead, the bills increase the level of burdensome regulation for livestock farms in Illinois, he said. Illinois Pork Producers Association spokeswoman Jenny Jackson said the current state law provides a good balance between protecting the environment and permitting farmers to raise livestock. The answer isn't to place more regulatory burden on our livestock farmers, Jackson said. The answer is increasing consumer education. As pig farmers, we set a high bar for ourselves to be good animal caretakers and stewards of the land. We need to work harder to tell consumers our story. Democratic State Senator David Kaler of Peoria, a sponsor of two of the bills, called the measures a common-sense approach. He said the bills are modeled after laws in other states, including Iowa, Indiana, and Wisconsin. One bill would require all confinements to register with the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency. The second bill would close a frequently used loophole in state law that allows new confinements to be built without a permit when they can be deemed an expansion of prior livestock operations. The third bill would require that facilities to file waste management plans before they're constructed and to publicly disclose these plans if local residents and county officials request hearings on the proposed operations. The final bill would give neighbors the right to challenge the Agricultural Department in court if they believed mistakes were made in approving a construction permit. Our next article is entitled Students Make Intriguing Visit to Coroner's Office by Andy Kravitz from Peoria. Abby Kaczynski likes watching crime shows and kind of digs the whole forensic science thing, but that bone saw? Well, that was a bit much for the Dunlap High School senior. That kind of freaked me out, she said, surrounded by a group of her classmates who spent an afternoon at the Peoria County Coroner's Office. The visit was part of a day-long experience to see how their classwork relates to careers in the real world. They spent the morning at the Peoria County Sheriff's Office, where they watched crime scene technicians work up fingerprints. Coroner Jamie Harwood and his deputy coroner, Jeff Howard, went through the workings of their office, as well as how death investigations and autopsies work. Dunlap High School teacher Mary Ann Henry came up with the idea a few years ago. We want them to see the practical applications from what they are learning in the classroom as it relates to jobs after school, she said. Questions from students ranged from what was the most bizarre case to how does one run for office. Harwood gave frank answers on both and added a bit of humor to the hour-long visit. He quipped he watched a YouTube video to learn how to run for office and said he wasn't the best student in high school. So see, you can do anything if you put your mind to it, he joked. But the students also wanted to know what it's like to talk to a family after a person has died. Harwood said you need to be compassionate and understanding. If you don't like dealing with people, then this isn't a job for you, he said. Later he implored them to be careful with their choices and highlighted that point with a story about a recent drug overdose. "You think it can't happen to you, but it can. And then I have to tell your parents," he said. Alexis Loser and Chris Dorbeck, both seniors, enjoyed the field trip. Dorbeck might go into a career in law enforcement and isn't necessarily looking at forensics, but he said the class and the tour gives a good perspective. And Kaczynski? She enjoyed the visit, but it doesn't appear a job at the coroner's office is in her future. Now we'll turn to the obituaries. The first one is for Charles Wesley Mitchell, Jr., formerly of the Oakwood area, died at St. Mary's Hospital in Janesville, Wisconsin. Services will be held April 8th at 11 a.m. at Muncie Baptist Church to celebrate his life. James P. Hensley, 73, of Danville, died Monday, March 27, 2017, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Per his adamant request, there will be no services. In death, as in life, he lived true to himself. Catherine Byers, 71, of Vetersburg, Indiana, passed away at 8:23 a.m. Saturday, April 1, 2017, at Parkview Healthcare in Attica. Funeral service will be 11 a.m. Wednesday, April 5, 2017, at Sterling Christian Church, 701 South Sterling Avenue, Vetersburg, Indiana. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, April 4, 2017, at the church. David L. Fraley, 86, of Danville, died peacefully on March 25, 2017. Visitation will be from 8:45 to 9:45 a.m. Tuesday, April 4th, Mass at 9:45 a.m. at Holy Family Catholic Church, Danville. Sharon K. Bradford, 68, of Fairmont, passed away at 7:25 p.m. on Thursday, March 30th, 2017, at Presence Covenant Medical Center, Urbana. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, April 4th, at Robinson Chapel, Catlin. Visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. on Monday, April 3rd, at the chapel in Catlin. James E. Fletcher, 78, passed away at home on March 29, 2017. Graveside services will be held at Sunset Memorial Park, 3901 North Vermilion, Danville, on Monday at 1 p.m. Howard Thomas Farlow, 98, of Westville, entered eternal life at 11:59 p.m. Wednesday, March 29, 2017, at Presence United Samaritans Medical Center in Danville. Mass of Christian burial will be held Wednesday, April 5, 2016, at 11 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church, 231 North State Street, Westville. Military honors will be performed by the Westville American Legion, Post No. 51 Honor Guard. Visitation will be Tuesday, April 4th, 2017, at Sunset Urbas Funeral Chapel, 414 South State Street, Westville, from 4 to 6 p.m. The Rosary will be held Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. prior to visitation at the funeral home. Charles Ahrens, Charles J. Bear Ahrens, departed this life and began his new journey on Saturday, April 1st, 2017. A Mass of Christian burial will be held for Chuck at Holy Family Catholic Church, 444 East Main Street, Danville, on Wednesday, April 5th at 10 a.m. Charles Ray Bell, 88, of Rossville, died at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 31st, 2017, at Carl Foundation Hospital, Urbana. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Blurton Funeral Home of Hoopston. Kevin R. Freeman, 60, of Danville, died at 1:14 a.m. Sunday, April 2nd, 2017, at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Roordevelt Funeral Services of Tilton. And now we'll turn to an article concerning Vermilion County elections entitled Decision Time. It's a long day for judges, low turnout or not, by Noelle McGee from Danville. Donna Holuska, has already made a mental grocery list in anticipation of Tuesday's general consolidated election. Haluska is the head election judge for Georgetown Township Precinct 8, one of six located at St. Mary's Gym in Westville. She wants to make sure she and her fellow judges have sustenance to get through the day. I'll probably pick up donuts at Casey's, some peanut butter crackers, and probably some fruit, said Haluska, a judge for 36 years. Most of the judges from the other precincts bring in snacks, and everyone shares whether it's cookies or candy or ice water. You have to keep going when you're there from 5 in the morning until 8 at night. The polls will be open from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Election Day. While officials are anticipating higher traffic at St. Mary's, they're predicting overall turnout in Danville and the county to be low. Will Nesbitt, the Danville Election Commission director, predicted that about 15% of the city's 17,550 registered voters will go to the polls. Across the annex, Lindsay Light predicted an even lower turnout. 13% of the county's 30,282 registered voters. That's if we're lucky, said Light, chief deputy clerk and supervisor of elections. As of Thursday afternoon, Light had received 135 ballots in the mail and only 270 early voters, even though early voting started on February 23rd. Nesbitt's had gotten 249 mail-in ballots and 133 early voters. Unfortunately, I don't think it's on a lot of people's radar, he said, pointing out that only four city races, Danville School Board, two Danville Alderman races, and Danville Township Trustee, are contested. He added his staff has fielded very few phone calls, and he hasn't even seen that many election signs out this year. While it may be one of the lowest turnouts, Light said it's been one of the busiest elections for her preparation-wise. I have an 11.5-page specimen ballot compared to 1.5 pages for the presidential election. And I have 134 ballot styles compared to 20 in the presidential, Light said, pointing out that this election includes municipal, township and school, library and fire district races, and two referendums, and there are many different combinations of races. There's been a little more interest out in the county, she said. She said both Georgetown and Westville have a contested mayoral race, and 8 people are running for the 4 Georgetown Township trustee seats. This is the first time the Republicans have caucused in years, Light said. She said the races for Highway Commissioner in Seidel and Oakwood each have 3 candidates. Light also expects a decent turnout in the Bismarck-Henning and Rossville-Alvin school districts, where voters have a cooperative high school referendum on their ballots. If approved, the Bismarck-Henning-Rossville-Alvin Cooperative High School would open in the fall and be the second co-op high school in the state. The Blue Devils mascot and blue and white colors would stay the same. The majority of Rossville-Alvin 9th through 12th graders have been attending Bismarck-Henning High since their high school was closed 11 years ago, and administrators and school board members said both districts have a good relationship. We've put a lot of work into it, and the boards want to see it happen, Bismarck-Henning Superintendent Scott Watson said, adding it would increase the financial stability of both districts and curricular and extracurricular opportunities for students and give Rossville-Alvin residents a voice on the co-op school's board. Also, voters in the Kickapoo Fire Protection District will vote on whether to approve a $400,000 bond issue to renovate and expand its station, which is about 50 years old and outdated, and purchase new equipment. The bond would be paid off in about 10 years. This has been Dee reading the Vermilion County News for April 3rd, 2017. Have a good day, and I look forward to reading with you again.